Greetings and welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson coming at you from the Central Highlands of Tasmania. It's Friday, the 26th of April, 2019. This is the coldest weather I've been in since I was here in Tasmania a year ago. It's not freezing by any means, not at this elevation. We're at about 400 meters here, but it is quite chilly, and I think that it actually could have snowed last night up on Cradle Mountain, where I hope to be going in the next couple of days. But it's very, I'm actually sitting inside recording the show with my open windows and doors, but it is a bit chilly, and I'm really miss the warmth. I'm flashing back to my beautiful month in Rarotonga back in November and December. And even just where I was up in whale dreaming country in the central coast of New South Wales, I almost never had to have a shirt on, except at night. I'd really like to thank my friends here at the beautiful community of Lorena, which is the closest community to Cradle Mountain that exists. As the crow flies, it's probably only about 20 or 30 kilometers away. But for those of you who aren't familiar with Tasmania, it's an island about the size of Ireland that's south of Melbourne. It's the southernmost state of Australia, and it's separated by a body of water called Bass Strait, which is quite shallow. And if you look at it from a geological perspective, if the sea level dropped, oh, I don't know, I'm guessing a couple hundred meters, there would be not just the land bridge that goes from Wilson's Promontory via Flinders Island to northeast Tasmania. If the sea level dropped only 60 meters, that land bridge would probably open up. But if it dropped a couple of hundred meters, exposing the entire width of Bass Strait, a swath of land even wider than Tasmania at its widest extends all the way up to the east coast of Australia and over towards Adelaide. And so it would be interesting to know what kind of time frame geologists believe that that entire swath of land would have been connected with the mainland, because that would have just made it a whole different migratory route to be able to come down this far south from directly from Adelaide to down where we are now. It's a very interesting place. And Tasmania, along with Darwin, has been the places in Australia where I've had, of all the most amazing and powerful and enchanted things that have happened with me during my more than 19 years of being lucky enough to travel all around Australia and New Zealand, the most powerful and enchanted and amazing things have happened to me both in Darwin and in Tasmania. And, you know, I could make several radio shows just about those things, but just as a highlight, I very first came to Australia in July of 2000, thinking I was going to be here a few months. And in July of 2001, I boarded the Spirit of Tasmania in Melbourne and came here for my very first visit and just really fell in love with the place. And it was the first snow I'd seen since I'd been in Colorado, and had a very interesting experience. Of all my over 400,000 kilometers of hitchhiking since 1981, the only time anything actually happened that seemed like it might be the worst case scenario actually happening, because people have asked me that a million times. It's like, oh, well, look, did anything bad ever happen? And I go like, well, you know, no. You know, I've kind of felt weird vibes a few times, but nobody ever pulled a gun on me. Nobody ever tried to rob me or anything like that. But in Tasmania in 2001, this incident occurred where this bloke that had given me a ride before gave me a ride, and he tricked me into getting out of the vehicle in the middle of nowhere in central Tasmania And then he sped off with all my gear. But a week later, he had returned it all. And this is just probably the single most powerful and amazing chapter of probably anything that's happened to me in my whole life. This would probably be the pinnacle of just guardian angel, amazing orchestration and guardianship and just freaky, amazing stuff happening that there's no way that you could have predicted or even imagined that it would turn out like it did. But that happened here in Tasmania. And because of it, I made some really, really good friends who I'm still in touch with now. And one of them is a beautiful English musician, former policeman here, who came and helped me when that incident happened, named Graham Hollingsworth, or we call him Holly. And I've just got back in touch with him. And we were supposed to catch up down in Hobart last week, but his wife's dad is very ill, and so he wasn't able to see me. But we'll catch up next time. And then in 2003, well, and also in 2001, I met a really lovely woman named Louise Harrison, because she was working at a cafe where I asked if I could go and sit there and paint some rocks. And so she kind of liked what I did, and she had been spending some time on this island called Three Hummock Island, which is sort of off the northwest coast of Tasmania, at the homestead of this guy named Rob Alliston, whose family had grown up there. His dad used to be a commander in the British Navy, and they were likened to a Tasmanian version of the Swiss Family Robinson, growing up on a remote island and raising sheep and pretty much doing everything themselves. So Louise thought that Rob and I would really like each other, because apparently his vision for the homestead out there was to create a kind of sort of a miniature little sister version of this community in Scotland called Findhorn, where people would come there and you know, be free to be creative and live and grow vegetables and different kind of things like that. And so Rob and I got in touch. And we were supposed to meet in 2003, so I hitchhiked over to this town called Smithton in the northwest corner of Tasmania. And Rob's friend, who was a pilot, flew out there to get him and was going to bring him back. That's how he got back and forth from the island. He was going to meet me there. And I got there, and hours went by, and Rob wasn't there, and I didn't hear from him. So finally I made a phone call, and to my horror, found out that this plane had crashed on the way out there to Three Hummock, and the pilot was killed. This was a dear friend of Rob that he'd known for like 20 or 30 years. And so Rob was stuck there, and I was there in Smithton. And so I spent the night there and went on back down and spent the rest of my time in Tasmania. But that was very sad. And so then it took until, because Rob at that time had realized that he had Parkinson's disease. So he left the island and came to live in Hobart with his wife, Elaine. And it took until 2007 for me to actually catch up and meet Rob and Elaine in person. But we really hit it off. It was really, really cool. He was doing all kinds of esoteric, therapeutic processes to deal with the progression of his Parkinson's. And he also really loved the whales and dolphins, because he was very much of a maritime person. And he also loved the indigenous people of Tasmania and Australia and the world in general. So two of my very favorite things that I pay attention to and spend a lot of my life energy on behalf of. And so he commissioned a very beautiful mandala painting from me at that time, which I went and did the painting in Darwin in 2007. And that's when I met Lisbeth Verstraeten, who became my partner for 5 years. We met in Darwin, and I was actually working on Rob's painting at this time called Hunab Hiku. Also in 2007, I went out to Flinders Island for the first time, an island off the northeast coast of Tasmania, and met David and Leela Tresemer, this American kind of new age couple who have a property out there that used to be owned by this guy named Robert Lawler, a sort of another American thinker who wrote a really cool book called Voices of the First Day, Awakening in the Aboriginal Dreamtime. And so I also met Arne Erickson, who owns a remote property. He's kind of a reclusive, eccentric Swedish Finnish person who had been in the Swedish Merchant Navy for 20 years as a Morse code operator. Then in 1985, he bought this remote property, which saved him, he said, from alcoholism, and had built these various structures out there, kind of hut villages made from stuff that washed up on the beach and from the tip. Very cool person with no electricity except for just one little tiny solar panel. He didn't want it, but he did have a landline telephone put in. And so I went and stayed with him for a few days, and he was really cool, invited me to come back. And so then Lisbeth and I went there in 2008 and spent several weeks. And it was just ultra, ultra fantastic. We made our very first medicine wheel there. We met Jay and Jackie Hetzel, who owned the little art cafe at Killiecrankie, a little town near there. We were getting ready to leave because we were running low on money. And then they said, we went and saw them one day and took them a hand-painted rock, and they let us go online while they looked at our website. And after about an hour, they said, Jeff and Elizabeth, look, we love your art, and you know, we're coming up on our one-year anniversary of our JJ's on the Bay Cafe. So, you know, we wanted to ask, if we pay you whatever you ask, could you stay long enough to do some really cool artwork for us? And we go like, are you kidding? Absolutely. So we ended up doing a huge big mural about 3 meters long that depicted the landscape view of the beach there at Killiecrankie and the mountain and the ocean and the sky. And we painted a 55-gallon drum covered with sea life, and I did a round star painting for Jackie. So that was really cool. That was our first time, my second and our first time together at Arne's. We call it Balarnia because that's his nickname, Arne Balarny. Then in 2011, Lisbeth and I went back out there. And this time we went in July and stayed until early November. So we were there for over 4 months. And during this time is when we did this massive project called our Mother Earth Temple that started out to be our eighth medicine wheel. But when I realized that we had the freedom to do whatever we wanted and there was space there on this property, it turned into the Mother Earth Temple, which actually had 7 medicine wheels along an east-west axis over a 1,000 rocks, a metric ton or two of sand that we hauled up from the beach, over 100 painted rocks, a jed pillar at the crown chakra, a kiva, which is sort of a partially underground Native American structure, hexagonal in shape with a sand bed on top and a circle of rocks of 28 rocks depicting the lunar cycle. And almost the exact time when we completed it was the end of October, October 28th, 2011, which back then, I don't know how many people remember, there was a lot of hullabaloo about the Mayan calendar coming to an end and the whole thing with 2012. So this was October of 2011. And a lot of people were saying that the true ending of the Mayan calendar sequence was in October of 2011. So anyway, not that all that calendrical, those measurements really mean that much, but I was a little more into it back then. But it was interesting that was when our timing lined up, that we actually completed this Mother Earth Temple in honor of the sacred cosmologies of all cultures and certain people and cultures that we listed as who it was dedicated to and whose work influenced what we did there. And a large part of this is still standing on Arne's property there. Then Lisbeth and I went our separate ways in 2012, and 2013 or 14, I came back and was able to go to Flinders Island again and actually caught up with Lisbeth and stayed at Arne's. And then this is when Rob Alliston had set up a yurt at Lorena, this beautiful little remote community near Cradle Mountain where I actually am right now, he invited me to come and stay in his yurt while he was living in Hobart. And I did and met a lot of the lovely people here. And then in the next year or so, I went and stayed with Rob because he had a little house in Sheffield, the town where all the murals are. And it's got a beautiful view of Mount Roland, which has got one of the most spectacular views of any town in Tasmania. Stayed with Rob and was there when he took a fall and had to be hospitalized. And that's a whole story in itself. And then I got to know everyone at Lorena. And then also during this time, I met people who were running the visitor center at Mount Field, which is Tasmania and possibly Australia's very first national park, located in the southern central part of Tasmania, and where Russell Falls is and Lake Dobson, where lots of platypus live and these giant pandanus forests and the tarn shelf. It's a very amazing place. And it was the first I visited there in 2001. So they had me as artist in residence there at Mount Field and met some really cool people there and went to Russell Falls every day and had a really interesting experience where I was the only person sitting in the cafe one day and this whole busload of Chinese people came in. And I don't know who they were or what they did, but the vibe was so weird that I had to get up and leave until they left. I just couldn't stand the energy of whoever these people were. And that was quite creepy. And then also, a couple of years later, I met Barbara and Sue, who have an alternative healing community called Vortex at a town called Gray up near St. Mary's near the Bay of Fires in northeastern Tasmania. And I spent 2 or 3 weeks there, which was really, really cool. They let me use their extra ute, and I was able to go explore the Bay of Fires. And I've also met, last year when I was here, staying with Wouter and Elise. Wouter has a beautiful organic farm called Seven Springs, and he got me to paint the largest rock that I've ever painted, which is now standing at the entrance to their driveway. And then last year I met Adrian and Isabel, a beautiful couple, and their little babies, Xavier and Elias, with whom I'm staying right now. And we went and had dinner with Wouter and Elise the other night. So it's just a really beautiful community. So all my years of traveling in Tasmania and all the wonderful people I've met and all the beautiful support for my art that I've had has just been very, very amazing. And I forgot to mention that in 2003, I met another guy that Louise Harrison knew called Bruce Roberts, who I think that he had also gone out to Three Hummock Island. And he owned a building in Hobart that was like partially being used as a meditation center. So he commissioned me to do a mural in honor of this building. And it was about a 2.5 meter long mandala it's the most elaborate mandala that I've ever done, with Egyptian hieroglyphics and a sun. And it was really, really, really beautiful. And so, interestingly, Rob had this beautiful big painting that I had done for him called Hunab Hiku, which was a visual impression of how whales and dolphins use sound. And Bruce had this large mandala painting. And so when Rob sold his yurt at Lorena, he gave this painting back to me, which I then was able to resell to some local people, which was really, really cool. And then Bruce gave that mandala mural back to me, which I then was able to resell to a lovely woman who has a medical clinic in Hobart. And I know that now, after a year of sitting on the shelf, it's actually up in her foyer. And that was really, really cool. So Tasmania has been very, very lovely to me, and it continues to be my very favorite part of Australia. Now, the indigenous people from here are not extinct. That's kind of a myth or an incorrect belief held by a lot of people on the mainland, And again, the whole notion of indigenous and race and all this different kind of stuff, a lot of it is more a sociocultural artifact or creation than it is having anything to do with actual genetics or biology. Because we're all the human race. And the whole thing of, like, what does it mean to be indigenous? But anyway, but I think that the indigenous people from down here were a little bit different than a lot of the people on the mainland, even in terms of how they looked and their culture and stuff like that. They were probably closer to quite similar to the indigenous people of Tierra del Fuego, down in the extreme southern tip of South America, a people called the Yamana, who I learned about when I was there in 2007, apparently were so well adapted to their environment that they were able to swim naked in freezing ocean water, and they weren't even cold. They were able to do stuff like that until their whole vibrational structure changed after the advent of Europeans. But the Tasmanian Aboriginal people are not extinct. Their bloodline lives on in a woman the other day. He's kind of a tour guide that seemed to have some pretty good information. She said there's 20 or 30,000 people that claim to have Tasmanian Aboriginal blood. And so, again, it's kind of futile or meaningless to dwell on the percentage of this and that people have, because again, it's sort of emphasizing the differences between us rather than what we all have in common. And what we all have in common is a continuum that extends beyond just people, beyond just human people, into all of our family of life of plants and animals, and even into the trees and the rocks and the waters and the clouds. That's really, we're all connected in that kind of way. But the indigenous people of Tasmania, apparently there's a vast cave systems in central Tasmania where they lived. And I don't know, I'm such a fan of the indigenous people of Australia, because I think it's clearer now more than ever that they're the longest surviving culture of humans on this planet. And where I just came from, up in the central coast of New South Wales, what I call whale dreaming country, that is the place of the longest standing connection between humans and whales and dolphins. And I've done several interviews with whale dreaming elders to talk about this, and how when they told me their ancient beliefs, it resonated and verified something that I already believed. Like, for example, that the whales and dolphins were actually people before we were, and that they actually taught our ancestors how to become people and advance knowledge of possibly even having to do with communication, with understanding of cosmic context, like astronomical knowledge and things like that. But my interest in Tasmania and my connection, just like with how it became in North America and how it's always been in Australia and New Zealand, as much as I love my fellow man and have beautiful friends that I go and visit and hang out with and who make me possible, my strongest connection, and now more than ever, tends to be directly with the earth and non-human life forms. And if you look at the landscape features as being not just products or artifacts of the Dreamtime ancestors, but embodiments of these ancestors themselves, it's just an incredibly powerful way to look at wherever you might be. And I can say now, more than ever, as I've traveled extensively all around Australia several times, including down through Western Australia from Darwin to Perth and across the Nullarbor three different times, up through the center several times, up and down the East Coast several times. I have not yet been to Cape York, way up that way. But everywhere else I've covered pretty extensively. And I would still say that Tasmania as a whole, and including Flinders Island, has some of the most amazingly beautiful, unique and spectacular landscapes of anywhere I've seen, not only in Australia, but in the whole world. And this includes my comprehensive travels all over America and in southern, eastern, and western Canada, and in Chile, northern and southern Chile, and in Scotland. Tasmania has amazing, unique landforms, like, for example, Cradle Mountain and Dove Lake, this complex of, I guess it was formed by glaciers, but it looks kind of like some of the areas around a place called Lake Corusk in Scotland on the Isle of Skye. And there's also Freycinet National Park, that's Freycinet, on the east coast of Tasmania. And there's three giant granite mountains, one of which is called Mount Amos, that looks a lot like some similar places in Scotland. And it looks kind of like parts of the South Island of New Zealand in Fiordland, which looks kind of like the archipelago going from Puerto Montt down to Puerto Natales in southern Chile. And you've also got this giant mountain rising above Hobart called, now it's, they're using the indigenous name Kunyani, and the Europeans call it Mount Wellington, but it's a giant mountain about 1,500 feet high, or actually meters, 1,500 meters, made of dolerite columns. And it's a very, very spectacular mountain with very unique life forms up there. I'd like to honor a lot of indigenous Tasmanians, both past and present, who I've become aware of. There was a really beautiful little indigenous center at Devonport on the coast called Tiagara, founded by a guy named Peter Sims back in the 1970s. And a few years ago, I met the guy who was the director of it at that time, a partially Aboriginal person from here named Paul Docking. He was really cool. And I've interviewed him for my show. He and his wife live up in Queensland now. But he told me about a legendary leader of the Tasmanian Aboriginal people named Manalarangana, whose territory, he was the leader of one of the nine indigenous regions of Tasmania, the northeast corner, Manalarangana. And I've seen pictures of him. He was a really cool looking dude. And there was another legendary Tasmanian Aboriginal woman named Truganini, who these people were living at the time when the first Europeans came. And Truganini especially came to lead rebellions and actually raids against, to try to protect what was left of her people from the invading white man, who actually wasn't white. He brought the mental disorder of achromalexia, the misperception of one's color, that characterizes the man who calls himself white. Interestingly, Truganini's skeleton is on display in some kind of museum in London. How weird is that? As far as I know, it's still there. It's just so bizarre. I've met some really nice indigenous people from Tasmania. A nice woman named Risa Vox, who I met at Barbara and Sue's place at St. Mary's. They're involved with this thing called the 13 Grandmothers. And I met a nice woman named Dawn Blaisley out on Flinders Island. I actually helped her go and look and find her mother or grandmother's grave there, and we found it and did a little ceremony. She's a very talented artist herself. On Flinders Island in 2013, I met Ricky and Anita Maynard. Ricky Maynard is kind of like the Ansel Adams of Australia, a very talented photographer who spent a lot of time in America, and he told me some really shocking things about being a black person on Flinders Island. The dimension of Tasmania that I really wanted to talk about on this show is the fact that it's very much of a Gondwana land remnant land. Gondwana is a name given to the ancient supercontinent. I'm guessing that geologists think on the order of 250 million years ago is when it broke up, but it's really misleading to say that it broke up 250 million years ago because it makes it sound like it just happened all at once, whereas the continental drift and the separation of land masses and the spreading of the Earth's surface happens so slowly and gradually that it's completely imperceptible to us. And so you can't say that this process happened, because it would still be something that's going on now. It's just so slow that we can't perceive it. So it's really misleading to put a numerical figure on it. But anyway, as I understand it, the name Gondwana was given or created by a geologist, I believe in the 1950s, named Edward Seuss, just like Dr. Seuss, S-U-E-S-S. And I always thought that was really, really cool. But apparently, you know, when you look at these continents, you can see how it looks like Africa and South America and Australia and Antarctica, they kind of fit together like pieces of a puzzle. If the, you know, the Earth moved, if it all moved back to apparently where it looks like it came from. So on the surface, it makes a lot of sense. And I think that that's kind of agreed upon now in geological circles, that that's actually what is going on. But Tasmania is known to be, you know, because it's relatively isolated as an island, there's plants and animals that are endemic, meaning that they only occur here, nowhere else in the world. But then there's also Gondwana land remnant species that are here, also in parts of the South Island of New Zealand, and also in parts of southern Chile. And one of these is there's a myrtle tree, which I believe is the same as the Nothofagus, which is a beautiful little tree whose leaves are turning beautiful colors just about now. Oh, it's very nice on this cold, rainy day. The sun just now came out. Pardon me, I'm going to go have a look and see if I can see a rainbow in Aniwaniwa. Well, no rainbow that I can see. She might be down behind the trees, but it's one of those days where the sun keeps coming in and out. It'll be sunny for about 5 minutes, and then the clouds come, and it gets rainy again. It's quite chilly. It's very, very windy in the past couple of days. Normally, April tends to be the most stable weather in these latitudes. It's also early to mid-April is when I was in southern Chile in this place called Torres del Paine National Park in 2007, which was really amazing. But the Gondwana land connection is just really, really cool. And I'm not an expert on all the plants and animals and stuff. And where I just was up in, when my friend Craig and I went to Mount Yango, the sacred mountain up in whale dreaming country, a couple hours west of Gosford, there was a billboard that talked about that we were in the cradle of eucalyptus evolution. Eucalyptus is a type of tree it's not indigenous exclusively to Australia, although almost all of the species occur here. I think there are some maybe in South Africa and maybe in South America that do occur indigenously, as are also a type of animal, a type of mammal called marsupials that do not have a placenta. They have a pouch where the young are raised. So they're not exclusively indigenous to Australia. There are some marsupials, like, for example, there's a type of possum in America that's a marsupial, and I'm not sure where else that they occur, but they're largely, just like almost all of the species of eucalyptus are in Australia, almost all the species of marsupials are in Australia too. But among the plants here, just that I know about, you've got the Eucalyptus regnans, that's R-E-G-N-A-N-S, which is the tallest hardwood tree and the tallest flowering plant in the world. They can reach over 100 meters high. And I've met some of these trees at the Styx Reserve near Medina which is not far from Mount Field. These are huge, huge, huge ancient trees on the order of the giant Sequoia dendron giganteums, the redwood trees of California. And these are just some of the ones that you can actually access without going too far into the woods. There would be ones that are probably bigger that are so inaccessible that you'd have to sort of, people may not even know exactly where they are. Now, a lot of these giant trees are in danger from the logging industry in Tasmania, which is still very, very, very huge. It's not getting all that much publicity now like it was a few years ago, but I don't think it's packed up shop and gone away. There's another type of tree here called the King Billy Pine, and it's a small little tree that is very, very slow growing. I've seen ones around Dove Lake at Cradle Mountain that are only about less than half a meter in diameter, but they're over 1,000 years old, and they're not that really, they're kind of straight and not that tall with straight limbs sticking out, but they're very, very slow growing, and that's why a lot of them were destroyed in these fires that Tasmania has had in the past couple of years, these kind of fires that have never really occurred in historical times way up in the high central highlands areas. There's another plant called horizontal scrub that I believe occurs only in Tasmania, and it grows way down in the remote southwest area. And it also grows around Cradle Mountain at Dove Lake there, and you can see it. It looks like a tree crossed with a vine. The ones I've seen can get as big as, maybe 20 centimeters, 15 or 20 centimeters in diameter, but it's all curvy and viney and twisting around just like a vine going sideways with different parts coming out. So it literally is like a tree crossed with a vine, and supposedly that stuff can fill entire gorges or ravines, which would be almost impenetrable to a human person on foot, like with a backpack or anything, but it could easily be navigated by four-legged marsupial critters like the legendary Tasmanian tiger or the thylacine. Now, that's a whole story in itself. The thylacine supposedly went extinct from the last one in the Hobart Zoo in the 1930s. And the first year I was here, I was staying in Medina, and met a guy named Tommy, whose last name I forget, but he had grown up in Medina, and he said that his granddad had a thylacine as a pet, that its parents had got killed, and so they raised it, and it was like their pet. And he said this thing, his granddad told him that it was so sensitive to vibrations, and it could sense what was happening, that it knew if somebody was coming there to their house, like 30 minutes in advance, it would start to pace back and forth. And that was as accurate as a doorbell in terms of alerting them to someone that was coming to their property. And also that it could just be standing in the living room of their cabin, and they had these beams going across, you know, like that would support the ceiling, horizontal beams. And the thylacine would just jump up from standing like a cat and land on one of these beams that was taller than a person and just sit there. So they have very powerful hind legs for jumping, and supposedly it makes them kind of waddle a bit when they walk. Well, my really good friend Craig Garland, they also call him Gabo, who's a fisherman, took us in his boat out to the mouth of the Pyman River to go camping in the Tarkine in 2003. And he now owns a seafood restaurant in Stanley. And he said that he's actually seen them on the beach in the distance, a mother thylacine with her cubs, but not too close. But he said that they definitely still exist, that he's heard them, that they make a sound like this. Yip, 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 yip. And I've shared that with several other people, and they all agree that either they or people they know have heard them and seen them. So, and this woman I just met on the bus a couple of weeks ago, who's the tour guide, She said her husband was in the forestry industry for a long time, and that they saw them sort of on the out in the outer reaches coming around their campfire several times. And so it's kind of commonly known that they aren't extinct, but they're so sensitive and they're so endangered that they're not going to let themselves actually be fully seen by people, because if there was a full-on sighting of one, every asshole trophy hunting person with a gun would be down here to Tasmania trying to get it. And there was a story, I don't know if it's true, I can't remember who told me, but somebody actually published something in a newspaper here a few years ago about that they had solid proof that a thylacine still existed, and they kind of knew where they thought it might live or something like that. And anyway, these people started getting rocks through the window of their house because the public, did not want publicity about the thylacine. For this very reason. So you've got the largest, tallest hardwood trees on the planet. You've got some really unique life forms. You've got the king billy pine, the horizontal scrub. You've got these beautiful pandanus palms. Pandanuses grow all up and down the coast of Australia, but the ones down here are different. They're kind of like... It's kind of like a... It's not really like a cactus, but they tend to have one trunk with kind of these kind of palm-like fronds coming out. And some of them might have two or three heads coming out. And then they've got these kind of bristly, spine-like, stiff fronds sticking down. Kind of like, very much like a Dr. Seuss tree, like a kind of like a truffula tree might look in your imagination. You've got all the different kind of marsupials. You've got, in addition to the thylacine, you've got the Tasmanian devils, which are cute little kind of bear-like guys with really sharp teeth, supposedly with 9 times the jaw strength of a dog, and they'll eat anything, including bones, hair, leather, wood. They won't eat metal. And I think that they were being decimated by some kind of cancerous disease that was actually eating their faces, but I believe they're recovering from that now, the last I heard, and that there were several populations that they had isolated from the rest so that they would hopefully weren't going to come down with it. You've also got massive amounts of wombats here that are kind of like little, they're larger than the devils, and they're kind of like little bears, quite slow crossing the road. You've got millions of wallabies, like just outside in the yard here. I could probably look out and see one here, but especially when it gets closer to dark, they come out and people hit them quite often on the road. You have to be going quite slow in order to not hit any, because they just sort of run right in front of you. But they're so cute. They're like little kangaroos. And you've also got probably all different kinds of kangaroos. Down on Bruny Island, you've got albino wallabies, which I've seen. They're white. You've got platypus, probably more platypus than anywhere in Australia, in a lot of the rivers and streams here. And I've even been to a little reserve where there's a platypus crossing, where the platypus comes out and crosses this piece of land to get to the other body of water. I've got a picture of myself stooping down near the platypus crossing, and I've only seen a platypus once or twice, and just very briefly, because they're quite shy. But I saw one. I saw the back of its head, and then it dove down to go underneath the water. Very interesting. They have a bill like a duck, and also a poison gland on one of their hind claws that might be used if the males have to battle as part of their manly duties. You've also got quolls, which is kind of a cat-like marsupial, and they come in different designs. You've got the ones I've seen have white spots. A lot of the marsupials tend to be nocturnal. You've also got all kind of really cool birds here. You've got the white cockatoos that are kind of occur all around Australia. And you've got black cockatoos, my very, very favorites. In fact, a couple of them came flying over yesterday. The story goes, we learned on Flinders Island, that if you see black cockatoos and they're flying towards the ocean, it means it's going to rain. So if you try to find kind of some kind of logical reason for that, it would be that they're coming down from the higher area where the rain's probably already set in, coming down low. But when I was over near Medina 3 or 4 years ago, staying for a couple of days at a nice little cabin that belonged to some friends of mine, there was more black cockatoos than I've ever seen, like literally hundreds of them. And the sound was just so amazing. But the lady said that she reckoned they were there not so much because it was raining up high, but because they had been doing a lot of logging that was chopping down the trees where they all lived. So they were being forcibly dislocated from their home, as are so many of the life forms in Australia, especially the little koalas, the cute little, we call them koala bears, but they're not actually bears, but they're quite bear-like. Very, very cool. I got to know some of them on Magnetic Island, thanks to my friend Allie B, who's the vet up there. They've got a very healthy population there on Yunbanoon or Magnetic Island near Townsville, Queensland. But their forests where they live are just being decimated all up and down the East Coast. They're really endangered in a lot of areas. You've also got heaps of kookaburras here. And I love them, but my friend said that they'll actually come and eat little baby chicks. And the crows will too. You've got beautiful rosellas. I saw a beautiful eastern rosella just right on the tree out here the other day. And I saw some in the Hobart Botanical Garden. There's the orange-bellied parrot and the swift's parrot, which are both endangered here in Tasmania. And one of the biggest things that I always try to do in Tasmania now more than ever, with not that much success so far, is to create a degree of oceanic awareness or maritime awareness that Tasmania is an island surrounded by ocean, and you've got huge populations of whales and dolphins and all kind of other sea life all around, but the people here just basically are completely oblivious to the fact that the ocean is right there. Whereas in New Zealand, not that they don't have their share of island mentality, but they're acutely aware of New Zealand being an oceanic environment, and there's a lot of awareness and, unfortunately, exploitative capitalism, but awareness and acknowledgement of the existence of and the dangers to all the whale and dolphin populations there. And so I think Tasmania would probably have a similar population of whales and dolphins, but they're just invisible to people. There's not so many, you know, Tasmania is basically one big island. You've got a kind of complex series of peninsulas and archipelagos down around Hobart, but not like, for example, the North Island of New Zealand, which has, like, you know, heaps of just around Auckland and stuff. I don't know. It's just, there's way more awareness of whales and dolphins in New Zealand than in Tasmania. Here, there's almost none. When these people in Sheffield a few years ago wanted me to participate in this art project that was going to involve painting some rocks for a sidewalk that was going to be mosaiced, I wanted to paint whales and dolphins and sea life in honor of the fact that in the whole town that prides itself on having all the being like the mural capital of the world or of Australia, there was not a single one that I saw anything that had whales or dolphins or fish or sea turtles or even seals or manatees or dugongs or anything like that. So it's a struggle to try to create maritime awareness. Also, Hobart is a major portal to Antarctica for Australian science and research and industry and military. Not as major as Christchurch is for America, but still one of the two major access points to Antarctica other than Ushuaia. I love Tasmania. She is just a very, very, very special place, and I think it's probably one of the coolest and safest places to be living on this whole planet right now. I think it's a lot more, especially with the recent turn of events in New Zealand in the past couple of months. Australia and, well, Tasmania is almost a separate country from Australia. It's still bound by the federal laws and the legislation and all that stuff like that. But functionally speaking, it's almost like a separate country from Australia. And Hobart's a pretty progressive, almost city. It's probably got 300,000 people now, and the traffic's getting bad. But there's a lot of people from Europe there, which I think is a good thing. And you know, it is becoming more urbanized. But I love the Botanical Garden in Hobart. I spent a lot of time there when I was there last week visiting my beautiful tree friends, Sequoia dendron giganteum, the Araucaria trees, the hoop pines, the bunyas, the ginkgo biloba tree, the larch, which is one of the few deciduous conifers, the Wallamai pines that they discovered in the Wallamai National Park, which is in the Blue Mountains, that just, I think in the 1970s, is this ancient, cool, really cool-looking little tree that they, I don't think they even knew existed, or that maybe they had seen fossils of them, but they didn't know they were still alive, and then they found a group of them. So now they've got them growing in different places, but they're very, very, very cool and very Gondwana-looking. Gondwana. It's kind of ancient, prehistoric, and everything that's survived from Gondwana, including the white cockatoos and all these trees and plants and vegetation and everything, they've made it through at least one or two major planetary mass extinction events that took out the vast majority of life on the planet. These guys would have been alive at that time, and possibly because of the circumstance and situation of being in Tasmania, they were able to ride out these planetary catastrophes and come through it all. So it's another something to think about as Mother Earth is on the brink of, I think, what the Hopis call the Day of Purification, a time when Mother Earth and the universe cleanses the planet of all that's out of balance with life. And, you know, you could say that if a comet hits and takes us all out, that it was just a random event. But if we do live in a teleological universe in which there are higher creative awarenesses and beings, which would be closer to the story of the Dreamtime ancestors than that of modern science, it could be that Mother Earth is very aware of how off the rail that man the wise has become. And although she loves us as one of her beautiful children, she can't let us continue to be an increasing threat to the health of all of her other children, all her other family of life that we were really supposed to be the guardians of and the caretakers for, rather than its destroyers and devourers and desecrators. But this is, Tasmania is a very near and dear place to my heart. I'm so lucky to be here. I want to send out beautiful thanks to all my friends and in the spirit of my spiritual brother, Rob Alliston, who left us in November for the Andromeda Galaxy. I'm going to make a trip out to Three Hummock Island one of these days in your honor and do some beautiful time-lapse photography of the orange lichens. And maybe one day we'll be able to walk together across that great land bridge in the sky. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off from the Central Highlands of Tasmania. Please live simply so that others may simply live. Walk in beauty on a path with heart, and constantly reprogram and renavigate to your highest path. Good day.